Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's my good buddy, was in Bend, Oregon, one of my old stomping grounds by Mount Bachelor. I used to ski there all the time as a kid, and now he is in the great state of Arizona in Sedona. His name is Jesse Felder. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Hey, George, thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, now there's a lot to talk about. Just over the weekend, prior to that, we had Putin invade Ukraine, as everyone knows now, but it has escalated heavily over the weekend. The ruble is down, last I checked, by 30, 35%. Their central bank jacked rates to 20% or so. Everyone was saying that this is a huge deal because they got kicked off of the SWIFT system. I spoke with our good friend Jeff Snyder, and he kind of thinks that's fake news, if you will. Definitely impacts from a psychological standpoint, increases the demise of the ruble, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those banks can't get money back and forth. So I know you are just studying this stuff all the time. This is what you do. You live, eat, breathe, sleep this stuff. So what are your thoughts on what's going on around the world, and how should investors be looking at this?
No, I mean, first of all, I have to say, you know, I mean, what's going on in Ukraine is tragic when you look into it. And you know, I almost feel, bad talking about markets in the midst of all this thing. I mean, we have to have some perspective that, you know, some lives are being destroyed. And I have a great deal of sympathy for that. My son is stationed in the Air Force on a nuclear air base in Europe. So I'm involved or paying as close attention to the situation as anybody, trying to. But at the same time, you know, markets are my business, and you have to, you know, you can't just decide to not pay attention to this stuff. And you have to be able to look at these things, keep your head, and be able to react. And when the Russian stock market crashed last week, I love panic. Whenever you see panic in the markets, it grabs my attention. And so I looked at that as this is a really interesting opportunity to buy into panic, because normally when you can do that, that's when you find the some of the best long-term opportunities in the markets.
Right.
And so, Wednesday started buying up some of these, Russian stocks. Cause I mean, at 2 to 3 times earnings, it's incredibly cheap. Yep. Yeah. To me, it seems, you know, like there's a margin of safety there, and you're getting paid to take the risk, the risks that are out there. And one of those risks is that the market doesn't trade again for a long time. I mean, they closed the Russian stock market in 1917. I think I saw somebody tweeting it didn't reopen again for 75 years. So there is, you know, there are risks out there that these things can are major. But when you look at it, panic selling and incredibly depressed valuations, to me, it looked like an interesting opportunity. But after I put the trade on, I never felt comfortable with it. And I ended up just closing out the trade at a loss, but pretty quickly. We can talk about it if you like. I really do think
let's go through the psychological components there, because the more I understand and the more I talk to experts and professionals like you and other hedge fund managers and bond traders and then going back to conversations we've had in the past about the Market Wizards books, the more I realize that probably the biggest part of being successful as an investor or a trader is all psychological. It's just getting out of your own way, and then risk management, and then it's about controlling your emotions and knowing when to buy and when to sell. And it's easy to say ride your winners and cut your losers, but that's a lot different when you're trying to do that under extreme amount of pressure, not just as a hedge fund manager managing billions of dollars, but probably even more pressure when it's you managing your own life savings. So yeah. Walk us through the emotions and the thought process.
Yeah, you know, I can compare this to, you know, trades that I've made in the past. During the Deepwater Horizon spill, I stepped in and started buying BP stock in massive size for my own, you know, personal account and for accounts that I was managing at the time, because I had a really good belief in what the intrinsic value of those shares were. And I had a lot of confidence in that. And so essentially, if I remember the numbers correctly, I mean, this was a decade ago, a little over, you know, the stock got absolutely crushed to the point where it was trading, you know, below tangible book value. And essentially, I think they were estimating the worst case scenario for the company was going to be something like $30 billion in costs over, you know, a 10, 20 year period for cleanup and liabilities and all those things. And when you looked at it, the company was generating cash flow of $30 billion a year. So there was no way the stock was trading as if the company was going bankrupt. It was going to be gone forever.
Yeah.
And you could step in and buy the stock because even in the worst case scenario, you maybe wipe out 1 year's of cash, 1 year worth of cash flow. And so, you know, I've had this experience of buying into panic many, many times in the past. BP was just, you know, one example came to the top of my head. What I do think, you know, you'll find, and I'm glad you mentioned the Market Wizards books, that these are some, you know, I think you can read just the first two books are fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you'll have maybe 40 different traders that Jack Schwager, you know, profiles in these books. And every guy has a totally different way of making money in the markets. But what they all have in common is they are all very good at taking losses, mm-hmm. at recognizing. And so, you know, you go, okay, well, how do you know when to take a loss? Like, what's the, because I started buying BP and it kept going down, you know, for a little while before it rebounded. And so how do you know when to take that loss? And for me, I just didn't have that confidence in the intrinsic value of the Russian shares. I mean, there's a possibility that they go to zero, and I don't have the expertise to assess all of those potential risks. So I think if you look at it like a lottery ticket, you know, that's different than looking at it as an investment. If you look at it like, I'm going to buy this and forget about it, and in 5 years' time, it may have done something great, or it may have gone to zero, that's fine. But I think if you're buying it thinking that there's a margin of safety somewhere that protects your downside, that there's a high probability it won't go to zero, you know, then I don't have the ability to make that assessment. And so, you know, for me, I think the decision to take the loss is when I recognize I've made a mistake. I've moved out into an area that is beyond my level of expertise, my comfort level, and I feel like I've made a mistake. And one of my favorite Jesse Livermore quotes is, whenever you found you made a, you know, you're wrong in the markets, the only thing is to do is to be right. And that's by stopping, you know, stop being wrong. So that's, you know, cut your losses quickly, get out of the trade. And so for me, I felt like this was a mistake. I'm wrong here. Get out and move on.
Yeah, that makes, because that's really the key factor, is it's knowing when you're selling for the right reasons and then when you're selling for the wrong reasons. Because, you know, it takes me back to Jim Rogers, and I've had several conversations with him, and I explored one of the famous trades that he discussed, in fact, in Market Wizards, and that was shorting gold back in the late 1970s or 1980. And he said when he shorted gold that it went way up like the next day or two. And I mean, way up. And so, you know, I'm trying to understand, how was that not a time when Jim should have taken losses right there? Because your first loss is your best loss, and you want to manage that risk. But then there's times when it is more prudent to continue to hold the position. And I guess it goes back to what you're saying in your confidence in your ability to analyze the situation to some degree of confidence.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think, you know, it comes back to your experience. And I've had experiences of buying into panic that worked out, and I've had experiences buying into panic or shorting things that I think are euphoric, and then working out or not working out. And I think it's, You know, a big part of, you know, investing and trading is, I think a lot of people say to be successful, you need to learn how to disregard your emotions. And I think you need to learn how to just analyze them and appreciate them and understand them. And you get to know those feelings, that feeling of I'm buying into panic, but I know this is going to work, versus the feeling I'm buying into panic. And the last time I felt this way, it didn't work out very well for me. It actually continued going down. And so I think for me, it is a lot of that. It is that, you know, and this is, I think, maybe the important point is we all as traders or investors, you come up with a thesis and then you put that thesis into a trade. And, you know, those are two separate processes, right? And so you have to have a process for your thesis, whether that's you're a fundamental investor or you're trading, you know, you're trying to look for reversals in trading or what have you. And then when you put that trade into practice, you have to have a discipline for being able to manage that trade. So there's multiple levels of things that have to happen here. It was interesting. I talked with Julian Brigden about this over the last summer, how he comes up with a thesis of trading currencies. He's, you know, I think talking about the dollar index at the time. And then he waits and applies a trading discipline to that thesis. And I think that's really critical, is to, you know, be able to separate the thesis from the trading discipline. And I think in Jim's case, I'm a huge fan of Jim Rogers. He's, you know, his chapter in Market Wizards is brilliant. Yeah. But I think in his case, he has a great deal of experience in trading those reversals. And I think he probably had a great deal of confidence in the fact that what we were seeing in gold in the early 80s was an absolute blow off top. That you had, you know, I think he's even said, I think, you know, in that book, whenever you go against panic, and I know John Templeton has said this many times too, whenever you go against panic, odds are you're going to be right, you know, over a certain time frame. And gold in the early 80s was panic buying, absolute panic buying. It's the kind of the reverse of the panic selling we're seeing in
certain areas of the markets. I call it hysteria. Hysteria buying, panic selling, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you either have the fear of loss that causes people to sell, or you have like extreme fear of missing out that causes people to buy at the top. And so it's still fear that drives a lot of that. And so I think that's, you know, Rogers is just a genius at that, looking at those fear trades in the market and taking the other side. And so I think it was his personal experience of shorting things like that in the past and knowing, man, anytime a setup comes across your screen like this, you know, you have to take advantage. And this is another point too, that comes across in the Market Wizards books that I love, which is if you just pretend you're not a trader, pretend you're not an investor, until an opportunity comes along that is so compelling, you have to take advantage of it. Your batting percentage is going to go way, way up. And I think that's what Jim does. Yeah. I think he just kind of like pays attention to the markets. He doesn't feel like he has to trade all the time. But when something comes across his screen that's like, wow, this is unbelievable, I have to put a trade on, you know, those are the types of opportunities he's looking for to take advantage of.
Well, Jesse, remember what you do is you just sit there and wait, do nothing. And then all of a sudden, when a big pile of money shows up in the corner, all you do is go pick it up.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And for those of you who haven't read the Market Wizards book, I'm paraphrasing a quote from Jim in the book, is right, what his investment strategy is.
Absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. You nailed the quote. I kind of paraphrased it in my own long-winded fashion.
Yeah. So I'm going to have my assistant reach out to Jim and get him back on the show soon if he's got some time. But, you know, a fun thought experiment, and I'd love, since you're such a big fan of Jim, he's my favorite investor. What do you think he would do if you had to put $5 as to what Jim would do or is doing maybe right now with this Russia situation? What do you think?
Well, you know, I thought about him because, you know, he always goes into those most, you know, those situations where as soon as you hear the idea, you go, has he lost his mind? And, you know, and that's how I felt, honestly, buying BP stock. I was at a golf tournament at the time with a bunch of brokers. And You know, we're talking about markets, and you know, they said, "Well, you know, what are you doing in the market?" And I said, "I'm buying BP." And they all like dropped their lunch and looked at me like, "Are you crazy?" And I thought, "I need to go buy more," right? Because that's the reaction that you want. You know, that tells you you're getting a good bargain. But I'll say, you know, I don't know. I would be surprised if Jim were buying Russian stocks. I think, you know, one of the things that concerned me about the trade is when you look at the history of you know, modern history and the losers of wars, the time to invest in those countries is after the war's over and they're in that rebuilding process. You know, so I think that, you know, if I were to take a look at it again, you know, it would be probably from that standpoint, because it doesn't look like Russia's winning this war. And even if they do accomplish what they're trying to in Ukraine, the costs to their economy and things. And you know, it's been surprising to see so much, you know, unification of the rest of the world. Even China seems like they've kind of flipped from supporting Putin and being on Russia's side to now saying, wait a second, we can't afford to be shunned by the rest of the world like Rutten is now happening to Russia. So I think, you know, from that standpoint, I'd probably be looking at something from the standpoint of after things, you know, all kind of play out. The only time to invest in the loser of a war is probably after their rebuilding has gone, you know, process has begun.
Well, let's go back to one thing, another thing that Jim has probably taught both of us, either directly or indirectly, is you wait for a catalyst. Remember, he always would wait for a catalyst. He would look at, I remember him having the discussion, I think it was the German stocks back in the late, or maybe the mid 70s or something was happening with Germany, or maybe it was the early 80s. And the German market hadn't gone anywhere for like 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
And he went in and bought a lot of German stocks. And Jack asked him, you know, why did you do that? And he says, well, because it's cheap. And then Jack said, well, Jim, you could have made that argument 15 years ago, and you'd be sitting on the money for 15 years. So what's different? And he says, well, that's a good point. He said, there was a catalyst. And what happened is there was some sort of election in Germany where there was someone, I think that was very pro-business, that got elected. And Jim said that he listened to his speeches and he believed that the guy was legit and was actually telling the truth. So when that guy got lit, or maybe just a couple of days prior, Jim went in and bought everything because he believed he was going to get elected. And then he believed that he was going to follow through on some of his promises that would take those stocks just from dirt cheap. No one's paying any attention to them, to something that everyone now is excited to buy. So I think that's maybe what you're saying with the Russian stocks, is they're cheap, put them on a watch list for sure. But then Jim might wait for a catalyst to buy, even if it's at a little higher price.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because obviously a ceasefire could result in a huge rally in these things, you know, not even an end to the war. And I'm not saying the trade's not going to work out. I mean, you could buy Russian stocks today and it could work out great. But yeah, the catalyst is an important point, right? I mean, what is going to put a bottom in these things? And, you know, it could be even just a technical catalyst, too, because you look at Japanese stocks peaked in 1990 and have been terrible to own since then until, you know, several years ago. And I remember 13D Research put out a piece when those stocks were technically starting to break out of a long-term base. Mm-hmm. And that was a terrific sign that it was time to go back into Japanese equity stuff. Yeah, they had been cheap for a long, long time. They've been cheap for a good reason, which is, you know, kind of how value traps work, right? I mean, you find things that are cheap and they get cheaper or stay cheap because they lack that catalyst. But, you know, you could point to a macro catalyst, or you can just, you know, look at the chart and see, you know what, this base is finally starting to break out. And that can be another, you know, catalyst or trigger to be, you know, signal that, okay, now it's finally time to get back into these things.
What comes to mind there is uranium. because it, and I'm sure you've followed this more closely than I'm sure, but it, you know, it goes way, way up in the last commodity cycle. I think it peaked out in 2011, maybe 2012, something like that. It goes way up to, what was it, 120, 130, 140, and then just crashed down. And then when it crashed down, everyone's saying that it's dirt cheap, but they're saying that for 8 years or whatever. Right. And then I remember back in March of 2020, it got even cheaper because of, you know, the COVID and whatnot, the lockdowns, and everyone selling everything. And, but then it really started to go back up, and then, you know, we've seen it spike and then come back down a little bit. But how were you following that? And did you get involved there? And if so, was the catalyst a fundamental catalyst or a technical catalyst?
Yeah, I never got involved in uranium. I'm still not involved. And that just brings me to one of my most important catalysts. And it was something that I couldn't have in the Russian stock market because I don't even know a way to track it. But one of the things I track most closely is insider activity. What are top executives at these companies doing with their own shares? And I track this on an individual stock level and on a macro level. I mean, the total US stock market level. And so for me, you know, whenever there's something that I find that looks cheap in individual stock, I'll look to see what the insiders are doing. If the CFO is not going into the open market to buy money with his own, you know, buy shares with his own money, then why should I, right? I want these guys who know the business. I mean, no matter what I do, I'll never know the business as well as CEO, CFO, VP of, you know, all these different things, sales. And so when I think a stock's cheap, I'll look, and if the insiders are all selling, then I, you know, I better go back and do my homework again and say, what am I missing here? Because if these guys don't see the opportunity, you know, why should I? So I never found an opportunity in uranium where I found a stock that had compelling insider buying and the insiders were telling me it's time to trade this thing. Now, on the other side of the equation, back in the fall of 2020, and still to this day, but especially in the fall of 2020, just a few months after the oil price went negative, we had insiders buying energy stocks hand over fist, right? It was right around the time too, where the Dow Jones Industrial Average kicked ExxonMobil out, I think in order to add Salesforce. And you look at the performance of those two stocks since then, and Exxon has been straight up, Salesforce has been straight down. And so, I mean, you get those types of wonderful contrarian signals, and they're fantastic, especially when they come on top of something like, you know, Harold Hamm, and during that third quarter conference call for Continental Resources, or second quarter conference call in 2020, was saying the stock is incredibly cheap. I'm stepping into the market to buy $100 million in the open market, and I'm going to keep buying with my own money until I don't think the stock's cheap, you know, cheap anymore. And he's been buying, you know, $30 million here, $20 million there. And you see this across the energy sector. And so to me, that's something where I can come in and I can say, you know, ESG has essentially created this structural dynamic where money's just not going into the energy sector. It's becoming cheaper and cheaper. And from a capital cycle standpoint, the underinvestment in oil over the last 5-6 years has been huge, which you know, is bullish for supply and demand, which we're seeing today. But also, you know, the investors have shunned the sector because of their kind of blind adherence to the, you know, ESG mandates. And so when you kind of come up with a thesis like that, and then you see insiders step in and buying hand over fist, PBF Energy is another one, you know, refiner, where the insiders have been so prescient there. I mean, they know how to time their shares. When you see them, you know, across the board, the whole, you know, executive team step in and start buying stock, to me, that goes, okay, this is an interesting opportunity. And the smartest of smart money is putting their money where their mouths are. And so that for me is a catalyst that is absolutely crucial to what I do. And we can talk about it on the macro side of things too, but on a micro standpoint, it's like I said, it's crucial.
Yeah. Let me try to articulate how I determine if something is cheap or expensive. It's very, very basic. And let's just look at oil, because that's one of the easy ones for me. is I just look at a long-term chart adjusted for inflation. And when I do that, I come to the conclusion that when oil gets under 30 a barrel, it's pretty cheap. And then when it gets over maybe 80 or 85, it tends to be expensive. And so when I bought a lot of oil producers back in March 2020 as well, and I did so, I think oil was maybe around 22 or 23. And I remember this like it was yesterday. I just got done listening to an episode of Macro Voices with Eric. And they were discussing how oil would probably go down further, and it totally made sense. I thought oil was going to go down to 10 bucks, you know, something like that. But I went in and bought a lot of the producers when it was still trading at 20 or 22, 23, because it was cheap, because it was under 30. And I knew that I didn't want to time the market. I couldn't, you know, that's too sophisticated for me. So I'm just going to buy it when it's cheap and then hopefully sell it when it's expensive. Now that it's at 110, so I would say, okay, now it's expensive based on my chart, but why should I reconsider that? Do you know what I'm trying to say? I'm saying, so technically the commodity is cheap, but why should, if that's my framework, why should I not sell? Why should I reevaluate to say, okay, well, maybe historically speaking it is, but because of the supply demand dynamics moving forward, it may not be expensive. It may still be cheap. Am I making that clear?
It's a great question. I think, you know, I'm really glad you brought up the inflation adjusted price, because look at the last time oil was $100 a barrel. It was like 2013, 14, I think. And the supply demand dynamics were way more bearish than they are today, right? Oil inventories are the lowest they've been. You know, we're seeing demand come back in a big way, right? Demand, you know, could set a new record here in the next year or two. And supplies are the lowest they've been compared to, you know, the five-year average that we've seen in, you know, in modern times, really. So the supply demand dynamics are way more bullish the last time oil was $100 a barrel. Now, the last time $100 a barrel was, like I said, almost a decade ago. So what's the inflation adjusted price? You know, from 2012, 13, it's more like 140 on, you know, in today's dollars. So, you know, and then if you look back at the 2008, you know, price peak in energy, you're talking an inflation adjusted price of like $180 a barrel. So I look at this way: if supply demand dynamics are the most bullish that we've seen in a long, long time, and that's just because we've chronically underinvested in energy since the price crashed, you know, in 14, 15, you know, these supply dynamic, you know, demand dynamics aren't going to reverse in bearish fashion anytime soon. We're not drilling, you know, like we need to be to kind of make up the supply side. And demand's not going away, right? We're selling electric cars, but electric cars and things aren't going to make up the majority of the cars on the road for decades. Mm-hmm. So you know, the situation is we have a structurally bullish, you know, fundamental backdrop for the oil price. And I don't see why it can't go to $140, $180 a barrel, you know, over the next 6 to 12 months, honestly, because unless we get a recession, I think that's the wild card. If the Fed does say we're going to raise rates, we're going to create a recession, it's the only way we can rein in inflation, then, you know, the oil price probably pulls back. I think, you know, one of the things I look at in terms of that is the Commitment of Traders report, and you see commercials, you know, in commercial traders, hedgers in the oil markets and oil futures, they're not short. They're not selling forward any you know, production. Oil producers are, and so to me, that's the smartest of the smart money saying, why should we feel the need? The supply demand dynamics are there. They're bullish. The trend is higher. So why should we sell forward a ton of production right now? That's pretty rare when you see commercials, you know, have some of their lowest short positions as a percent of open interest, even as the price is ripping higher. So, you know, that's kind of my version of looking at what are the insiders doing in the energy markets. Well, they're not selling. And you would think that, you know, look at all these previous past price peaks, you know, look at 2013, 14 before the price crashed, you saw hedging massively go up, right? Right ahead of that price crash. And that was the insiders telling you, hey, we're locking in prices. Now is the time to sell. And we're kind of have the opposite dynamic right now. So I think inflation adjusted, you know, it's not unreasonable that, you know, oil could be 140 here in the next 6 to 12 months. And, you know, by the same token, I'm not trading the oil, you know, futures contract. I'm trading those energy stocks. And I don't see any selling there. I still see insider buying, you know, here and there. And when you look at energy as a percent of the S&P 500, it's like 3%, right? Energy stocks only make up 3% of the S&P. You know, last time oil was $100 a barrel, they were like 10% of the S&P 500. So we the stocks are discounting a mean reversion in the oil price back to, you know, like you're talking about $70, $80 a barrel, something like that, even lower. Right. I mean, the stocks aren't discounting the cash flow that they're going to produce if oil even stays at $100 a barrel. So the stocks, I think, are really, you know, incredibly cheap compared to the commodity. And I don't see any reason why the commodity is going to reverse significantly anytime soon.
Yeah. To back that up, Jesse, we got to think about Russia being 25% of global supply. And if that is sanctioned or taken offline, then, you know, what happens to total supply then, or the demand supply demand imbalance? Another thing to back you up is I spoke with Art Berman today. Do you know Art?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Big fan of his work.
Yeah. And he was, you know, he just has, whenever I talk to him, he's got like 25 of the most amazing charts you've ever seen, but he really gets in the weeds with the demand supply dynamics. And he was pointing out the exact same thing, that the supply right now is in worse shape than it was back when we sanctioned Iran. He was making those comparisons. Yeah. And, you know, the price really shot up then, but the supply deficit that we have now going into potential Russian sanctions, or what the conflict here, is even more extreme than it was back in when they did this to Iran. I believe it was 2018.
Yeah. Well, I would just, I mean, the chart that I would show people is just look at a long-term, and this, I got this from Gehring and Rosenzweig, who I think, you know, they're commodity investors that do just brilliant work. You look at the ratio of, you know, the commodities index to the Dow Jones Industrial Average. And, you know, you have these long cycles where, you know, commodities outperform and then stocks outperform. And that ratio has been just bumped for, you know, 5, 6, 7 years now. It's been just bumping along its historical lows, and it's only started to tick higher. So people think, you know, this commodities trade, it's over, right? But if these long-term cycles, you know, hold, then it's actually just beginning, right? That this ratio... you know, and Paul Tudor Jones has framed it as real assets are incredibly cheap still relative to financial assets. And I would say, you know, that's the thing to keep in mind, is we think commodities have ripped higher, but look at what the stock market's done. Look at what the money supply has done. Look at what all these things have done. And if this, we're now reversing back in favor of commodities versus stocks, then that trade has only just begun to tick higher. It still has many years to go.
When you're trying to analyze if something like gold or oil is cheap, do you use M2? So because you got to compare it to the amount of dollars that are circulating in the real economy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. That's not part of my process. But you know, what I look at is essentially, you know, I mentioned these capital cycles. When you look at the amount of investment, just look at the percentage of S&P 500 capital expenditures in every sector, right? And this is an interesting way to do this. You know, when a sector comes to dominate capital expenditures over a number of years, that investment creates oversupply and you know, bad price dynamics. And so in the late 90s, right into the 2000 dot-com mania peak, we saw technology represented like a huge amount of S&P CapEx. And so much money was flowing into, you know, IPOs for new tech companies and all this stuff. And what did that, all that overinvestment result in? huge crash in the NASDAQ and on all these stocks, and actually huge oversupplies in computers and all these things related to Y2K, and they had inventory problems, and you know, there was a lot going on. At the same time, you know, the oil price and precious metals had performed so poorly for so long by the time we got to 2000 that there was just a decade of dramatic underinvestment. And so what happened over the next 10 years, right? The NASDAQ went nowhere from 2000 to 2012 or whatever. And commodities ripped higher for a decade, from about 2000 to 2008, you know, for the oil price or whatever, and 2011 for the gold price. And then we saw, what did we see then? We saw massive overinvestment in precious metals mining and in fracking. I mean, so much of the cheap money that the Fed provided in after the financial crisis went into loans to all these frackers. And so they overinvested, right, in the production of all these commodities. What happened? We saw a price crash in gold in, you know, 2012, 13, 14. We saw a price crash in oil in, you know, 14, 15. And that was all basically due to that overinvestment, you know, that happened a few years earlier. So where are we today? We've seen, you know, this 10-year plus run in tech stocks that's resulted in more overinvestment in the sector today than we saw in 2000, right? It's actually the CapEx that we've seen in technology in the last few years blows away, you know, even as a percentage of the S&P 500, what we saw in 2000. At the same time, what happened after those the price crashes in precious metals and oil? We saw chronic underinvestment in not just precious metals, but in, you know, copper mining and all the investment in all these raw materials, precious metals and oil. And so now you have supply dynamic, you know, in commodities where the chronic underinvestment leads to super bullish supply demand dynamics and all this massive overinvestment. Just look at all the, you know, the IPOs that we saw over the last 2 years and all the SPACs, you know, that all invested in, you know, new technologies and things, and all of that money that just went into tech. It's chronic overinvestment. We're already seeing it blow up, right? We're seeing a lot of stocks down 60, 80, 90% in those tech names. And at the same time, we're seeing, you know, a lot of, you know, oil stocks were the best performers last year in the stock market. And so far this year, best performing sector in the stock market, and still they only represent 3% of the S&P 500. So, you know, you can bet on that trade reverting a little bit, tech becoming a little bit less of the S&P 500, maybe energy, materials, precious metals becoming a little bit bigger part of the broad stock market. I think that's a trend that continues for a number of years based on those simple capital flow dynamics.
Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
Yeah, well, they're simple, but a lot of people overlook them. So I think it's really great insight to share with the audience. You mentioned the Fed there, and today is Wednesday, not sure the date, maybe the 2nd of March. And I believe Jerome Powell came out and had some words for Congress. Did you listen to what he was saying, and what was your take if you did?
Yeah, you know, I didn't listen to it live. I was trading through that period. And I think it's more important to just, I mean, I follow, I almost never listen to the press conferences. I'll read the news the next day because I think the market reaction is what I'm interested in. And also the media's representation of it, because the narratives surrounding these things are more important than actually what Powell said. And so I do think it sounded like, you know, I saw headlines sound like 50 basis points is maybe still on the table for different meetings. You know, they are in such a bind right now that I think, you know, there are long-term structural forces of inflation now that are at work and behind what we're seeing in inflation today, in addition to all the money printing and things, right, that are obviously play a large role. But I think there's a lot of other things going on that the Fed has no power to control. And so, you know, the Fed is tasked, right, with reining in inflation, right? Joe Biden talked about it last night in the State of the Union address. They have to address it. Inflation is one of those things where if you want to keep your office, your political office, you got to do something about it. Because you look at just the University of Michigan consumer sentiment stuff, and it's plunging. I think it's like at its lowest levels since, you know, the financial crisis, and people are unhappy about inflation. And so, you know, Jay Powell has to do something about it, but it's almost impossible for him to do enough. I think the only way they rein in inflation to any meaningful degree is by creating a recession, by reining in demand enough to create a recession. And I don't know if they're willing to do that.
Yeah. So let's try to unpack that, because if you're Jerome Powell, you're in now what's happening in Russia and Ukraine, that adds more, far more complexity to a previously very, very complex situation to begin with. So you're sitting there thinking, okay, we've got CPI at 7.5. I'm getting a lot of heat from the Biden administration, because if we don't get this down, to your point, they're not going to get reelected. And that's what it's all about for them. It's this political kryptonite. But if I do raise too quickly, then the stock market goes down. And sure, we get the CPI down to 4 or 5, but now all of a sudden the economy is tanking because it's so dependent on asset bubbles. So how does he stick this landing? Because I think if, and we were talking about this the other day, where for me, if I just look at surface level, because there is so much aggregate demand that is a result of these high asset prices, if they can kind of just get these asset prices down in an orderly fashion, you know, not a 20% in 1 week, but maybe a 20% over 6 months, and then the government doesn't deficit spend to the tune of $5 or $3 trillion, you can go back to 2020 or 2021, then it, you know, is it possible for them to kind of stick this landing and kind of have their cake and eat it too? Or are these structural components so powerful that they would still have to take rates to a level that exceeded the CPI, like Volcker, to really get them down long term? And then we mean CPI down.
Yeah, I think the idea of, you know, sticking the landing is, you know, wishful thinking to the nth degree, right? I mean, it's like threading the impossible needle. I mean, there's all kinds of analogies, but there was a great quote in the latest issue of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, where I think they said, to understand where we are in these monetary times, know that the Fed could raise rates by 0.25% 37 times and still not be at where the Taylor rule suggests that Fed funds rate should be. Taylor rule says Fed funds should be 9% today, wow, right? And we're at 0. So they could raise rates 37 times and still not get to where a systematic approach to monetary policy says they should be. That's how far behind.
That's the question. Sorry? Do they need to? Could they get it up to 2 or 3 and still have this impact on CPI?
It's not going to have that impact on the CPI. I mean, you know, I don't think so. Because let's talk a little bit about these structural forces. Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of people who've argued for, you know, that disinflation is the order of the day have pointed to demographics. Well, there's a great book that I haven't read yet, Charles Goodhart, and I can't remember his co-author's name, The Great Demographic Reversal. And they argue that what we're seeing today is a dramatic shift from disinflationary to inflationary forces based on the demographic shift in the economy. And essentially, you know, if I can paraphrase a book I didn't read. you have the baby boom generation, right? The biggest generation in U.S. history come into the workforce essentially right in the, you know, the 80s, 70s, 80s. Right as inflation was peaking, you had an increasing supply of labor. At the same time, you know, you had a trend towards shipping jobs overseas. So that was another huge supply shock, negative, you know, supply shock to the, or positive supply shock to the labor force that made it possible for companies to reduce costs and reduce prices for a long period of time. But I think in the great financial crisis, we saw a lot of baby boomers say, hey, I want to retire in 2007, 8, 9, 10, whatever. Their retirement accounts go in the toilet or cut in half. And they say, wait a second, I have to stay in the labor force. I can't afford to retire anymore. Sure. So you had this supply of labor kind of sustained for a period of time that longer than it should have. And now the stock market's up, you know, 2, 3, 4 fold from those 2009 lows. And they printed a bunch of money, pushed it even higher. And the pandemic, you know, inspires a lot of boomers to say, okay, you know what? I stayed in the labor force 10 years longer than I wanted to. Now it's finally time to retire. And so, boom, they're gone out of the labor force. And that was kind of a natural thing that should have happened over time, but it happened, you know, overnight, seemingly. But there, I think it's the BIS put out a report 3, 4 years ago that shows this shift in demographics is inflationary. When you have, you know, a growing percentage of your population is out of the workforce due to retirement or too young or whatever, and they're reliant on a smaller share of the population as the workforce, that is an inflationary dynamic in every economy throughout history. And that's what we're facing right now, is you're having a growing share of people who are not in the labor force relative to a smaller share of people who are supporting the entire economy. That's very inflationary. And I think we saw that, we're seeing that today, but we're seeing it was accelerated by the pandemic.
So labor shortage, wages go up, prices go up.
Right. And at the same time as these demographic things we're seeing, Joe Biden, I think, was a little bit disingenuous last night in talking about when we were going to fix inflation is by reshoring a lot of this production. Well, something, you know, that we need to do. But the offshoring of labor and offshoring production was probably the, you know, at least as important as demographics in creating disinflation in the economy over the last, you know, 30, 40 years. So the idea that bringing all this production back home is going to lower costs is, you know, ridiculous. It's going to actually raise costs, something we need to do. You know, we obviously found that we offshored way too much production of things that are critical to national security and, you know, all these things. And we say, we can't afford to do this, right? This is a bad idea. Just look at how our energy independence today, the fact that we supported the energy industry through the last 10, 15 years has actually put us in a better position in terms of national security than a lot of countries in Europe. You know, that's kind of an analogy. I think we need to look at a lot of other supply chains, and that's what we're doing now. But this reshoring of production is going to be another inflationary force because it's going to put more demands on the smaller, you know, labor supply, right? We're not going to be able to use the labor overseas to produce a lot of these things. So this is going to create even greater labor shortages and more pressure on labor. So, you know, these dynamics are structural that the Fed really has, you know, can't do anything about. And so I think that, like I said, without creating a recession, they're not going to be able to bring inflation back under control at this point.
Let me give you a counter argument for your last point.
Yeah.
Stock market goes down 30%. They have a tough time getting it back up because the Fed put has expired or for whatever reason. A lot of those people that retired over the last 2 years because they could, because the stock market went up so much, or they bought Dogecoin or something like that. Now, all of a sudden, they're where the people were back in 2009, where their 401k got a 50% haircut. Do they go back to work? And could that mean we go from a labor shortage to a labor surplus, which could add some disinflationary pressure?
You know, I think those are, you know, even the, you know, 2009 episode that forced people to stay in the labor force. You know, those are kind of, you know, I'd almost call it like, cyclical trends within a secular, larger secular. The larger secular trend is this dwindling supply of labor relative to the population. So that's not going to change. That's just kind of the baked into the cake demographic situation that we're in. Now, you're going to have these cyclical swings for sure. And if the Fed does, if they create a stock market crash, then you might push. And I've even seen, pundits argue the Fed needs to hurt people's, retirement accounts to get them to go back into the workforce. Now, I don't know if ethically that's, something that you could argue for. And I don't think the Fed is willing to do either, because when you create an asset price bust, you put all these wealth effects into reverse, right? That's what the Fed is the most afraid of, is the negative wealth effect and a Great Depression, right? Which is, you get crashing stock market, you get people saying, I need to be more careful with my spending because my retirement account went down. And you get all of these psychological dynamics that are the opposite of the inflationary ones we have today that create a Great Depression. So I think, the Fed does have the ability. I mean, they could crash the market tomorrow if they wanted to. Are they willing to do that? I think that they've made it really, really clear in recent years that the full employment side of the mandate is 10 times more important than the stable prices side. And they're going to bias in that direction almost no matter what, that we're going to do anything to hurt employment. And that means the stable prices side of the mandate is the side that they let go.
How high do you think that would have to get before they changed their mind or reprioritized?
How high would the stock market have to get?
No, the prices. High would CPI? I mean, do you think if CPI, this is a thought experiment, think if CPI was 15%? That it would still be okay, we've got to protect the wealth effect above and beyond, just crushing the poor and middle class with high CPI?
Yeah, I think what I'm most afraid of is, right, nothing goes in a straight line. I think what I'm most afraid of is that we get a local peak in CPI sometime over the next few months, and the Fed says, okay, look, it's gone from 7.5, 6.5, 5.5, 4.5, maybe. Look, it's coming in. We don't have to keep tightening. We don't have to keep, doing these things. But, unless it comes back below 2, right? You're still, you could argue the stable prices mandate means 0% inflation, right? That's literally what stable prices mean.
I would argue that.
So the idea that 2% inflation means stable prices is, asinine in the first place. But in, as long as they're above 2%, I think they need to be hawkish. I just don't think they're willing to do that. I think we could see a local peak in inflation. And, just look at the 70s, right?
Or the 40s, 70s. Better.
You had these spikes of inflation, but they came back down. And so every time it came back down, it felt like, oh, okay, maybe our inflation problem's going away. And then no, it spiked, back up again. And I think that we're probably facing a similar situation over the next decade, that inflation is in a secular uptrend now. And that doesn't mean it's going to stay at 7.5. It just means, it maybe comes down to 3, goes back up to 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe we even see some numbers in the teens, at some point. I don't think, what did it take to, in terms of psychology, in terms of consumer sentiment, all these things, for Paul Volcker to be able to do what he did? It took 15 years of inflation rising, out of control, essentially, before, and even still, even at that point, Paul Volcker did was against what everybody wanted him to do, that he was a pariah at the time he was doing it.
And two prior rate hikes, Jesse. Remember, we got to put ourselves in that mindset. Let's go back and pretend that we're in, when did he do that, 81 or 80?
Yeah.
I think 81, right?
Right.
So if we're there as just the average Joe and Jane, and Volcker says, you know what we need to do? We need to take rates positive. Real rates positive, and we need to crush the economy and create a recession. everyone would be like, it's not just the fact that they didn't want him to do that. It's the fact that that had been tried twice before in the 1970s, and it didn't work. It didn't stop inflation. But what it did do is either crush the economy and or crush the stock market. So you can imagine how emotional people were, like, no, what are you, you're absolutely out of your mind. We've tried this. It doesn't work. You're just going to ruin everything, and it's going to make things far, far worse. So I think that's a part of history that's underappreciated when you look at what Volcker was doing.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, I mean, unless you were in his shoes, you didn't really appreciate how difficult it was to piss off everybody in the world, right? And crash the largest economy on the planet, essentially create, super painful recession and all of those things that, you have to get to a place, very recently, right? It wasn't too long ago where Jay Powell said, too low inflation may be the greatest challenge of our time, right? And we're, Mario Draghi and people are saying, we're going to do whatever it takes to prop up markets and restoke inflation. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, we were just there, right? Where everybody is believing we don't have enough inflation, right? Inflation's now, as a result of that psychology, right, which, is embedded in everything from corporate policy to everything, inflation is never coming back. So we make all these decisions that ensure inflation comes back, right? Now that it comes back, it's going to take a long time. It's going to take probably, it pains me to say this, but it's going to take a lot of pain, I think, before we get to the point where we realize, no, it's not too low inflation that's the greatest challenge of our time. Now it's inflation. And we have to do whatever it takes to break the back of inflation. Yeah. But it's not going to just be a couple years of inflation being, above trend, even significantly above trend, to change people's mind in that regard.
And they need to know that nothing goes up in a straight line. I did a video the other day where I suggested that we continue to have extremely high rates of inflation, even as measured by the CPI, but in Q3 or Q4, it might go down a little bit. And then it all depends on what the government does, the Fed. And this was prior to Ukraine and Russia. And everyone in the comments just completely lost their mind because they said, oh, well, now you're a deflationist. And no, that doesn't.
It doesn't. No, I mean, if you have inflation 7.5%, in January of this year, and then January of next year, it's running 3%, right? That 2-year change is still massive, right? Yeah. Right. And so a 3% on top of a 7.5% is still, really big.
Right.
You look at, I think, the way to kind of show this to people is look at CPI compared to a 10-year trend line, right? CPI is just going boom, 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 boom. And then we've just gone so far above the trend line that it's silly, right? And in order to come back down to that trend line, we'd have to have deflation, for a number of months.
Oh, yeah.
In order to come just to get back to trend. And so, I think if you are arguing for inflation, you're saying, no, inflation is going to stay above that pre-pandemic trend, and it's not going to come back to trend anytime soon.
Yeah.
And you think about the math that's involved. Yeah. Look back at the CPI in the 70s, right? You had huge spikes and then it came way back down and then spiked again. It's not, inflation doesn't just go, you hope it doesn't just go 7%, 8%, 12%, 15% over a 3-5 year period, because then you're in hyperinflation and you've got a major problem.
Yep.
And that's a possibility. It's not, my base case, but it's a possibility. But I think, what's more likely is we do see these kind of, spikes in inflation. They come back and the trend in inflation is higher. The Fed doesn't have the will to break that trend at this point.
But to your point, that could make the next round or the next spike higher far greater, because we go from 7.5 to 8, let's say, then Q3, Q4, let's say it goes back down to 6, and then the government and the Fed say, oh, well, boy, we got past that. See, guys, it was just transitory. Now we can go back to doing all the things that we did before that created the inflation. And then 6 months later, now we're at 15.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think it's a lack of appreciation of these, the demographics, the deglobalization, And, you know, in these types of trends that, you know, people don't appreciate that we benefited from uniquely disinflationary trends over the last 30, 40 years. And that offshoring of labor is a one-time thing, can't do that anymore. And even, you know, costs around the world are going up. So even if you did say we're going to continue to offshore, well, that arbitrage trade is over, right? It's not as cheap to offshore. It's not as attractive financially as it once was because of all the related costs. And so, you know, that's over. And I think just appreciating that disinflationary trend of globalization lasted 40 years, and that's not, we don't have the benefit of that anymore. You know, it means that we can't do the things, right? Those were the things that enabled the Fed to pursue the most aggressive, expansionary monetary policy of the last 10 years that you know, maybe we've ever seen, were these disinflationary trends. Now that they're not there anymore, that ties the Fed's hands. They can't do that anymore. And that is a huge paradigm shift for markets that people really need to wrap their heads around.
Yeah, I try to get people to imagine the Fed doing QE in the 1970s. Or the government deficit spending to the tune of $5 trillion, or what would have been $5 trillion, or increasing M2 by 25%. You know, because we're so accustomed to the Fed put, whether it's psychological or direct or whatever, we're just so accustomed to stock market goes down, Fed comes in, you buy the dip, they do what they're going to do, market goes back up, and everyone's happy. So it's hard for us to get out of that mindset, even in an inflationary environment. And I think it's easier if we go back and read the stories of the 1970s and even watch Phil Donahue. Have you ever done that? Just as a, oh, yeah. You remember Phil Donahue?
Oh yeah, yeah, sure, of course.
I remember going back and listening to some of his interviews that he did with like Doug Casey and Milton Friedman. And Donahue, they're talking about inflation. They're talking, yeah. This was filmed, I don't know, 77, 78, 79, something like that. So they're sitting there talking about how inflation is terrible and what are they going to do? And, you know, everybody's talking about it, even the average Joe and Jane. And so I try to think about, okay, what would have happened back then if the Fed would have said, okay, we're going to expand our balance sheet by 50% in the next 2 years, or the government comes out and say, okay, we're going to deficit spend, or, you know what, we're going to keep real rates at negative 7.5% for the next 10 years. You know, what would they have done back in the 70s? They would have freaked out.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the most dangerous recipe probably for the stock market today. And there, you could argue profit margins have already peaked and are rolling over, right? There's been interesting studies, and this comes back to inflation. But when corporate executives on conference calls are talking about their pricing power, that's really good for profit margins, right? They're basically telling you, yeah, we can raise prices and we're going to make a ton of money. And that's what we've seen is companies were able to raise prices faster than their costs went up over the last few quarters. Explosion in S&P 500 earnings. But now they're talking about labor costs. Mm-hmm. And when they talk more about labor costs than pricing power, that's a good, you know, kind of early warning sign that profit margins are starting to come in. And so the worst thing that could happen to corporate America right now is that we reshore labor, raising costs for businesses, which is a good thing for America. Don't get me wrong. I mean, this buy American and reshoring production, all good. I'm all for it. But in the short term, that's going to raise costs dramatically. At the same time, let's put in price controls. Let's say you can't sell, you know, drugs for this much. We're going to put in, you know, caps for, you know, oil and gas and, you know, these types of things and products. We're going to, you know, implement price controls. You're basically just guaranteeing a crash in corporate earnings.
Yeah, right.
By raising costs and hemming in the top line during an inflationary time. So, you know, people could say Fed put all they want, right? But if those are the dynamics that are going on, earnings are going in the toilet. And that's just an absolute product of inflation and how policymakers react to inflation. And so, you know, that to me is something I'd be paying way more attention to is what's corporate costs doing? Are they going up? And is there any chance we're going to implement any kind of price controls? Because there's more and more talk in Congress about price gouging on behalf of corporations, you know, whether you're talking about like meat prices, you know, and the meat packing, you know, companies and things, or you're talking about, you know, oil and gas, or you're talking about, you know, drug prescription, drug prices, all that is saying, you know, we want price controls. And if you're talking about price controls at the time costs are going up, I mean, you could see, and I'll say, I have a leading indicator that I use for corporate earnings, and it's pointing to a huge plunge in corporate earnings into late this year, early next year. That's just something I stole from Stan Druckenmiller, who said, when you see the dollar, interest rates, and oil prices all go up together, that's a recipe for a corporate earnings recession. Mm. What have we seen in the last 18 months? Right. Dollar, interest rate, oil prices all screaming higher. That's an earnings recession, you know, 9 to 18 months in the future.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that, and they've got a convenient excuse now for inflation that might kind of bail them out. And that's that they can just blame everything on Putin. You know, people get pissed off at the gas prices or beef prices or anything that, you know, would prompt them to vote out the politicians. The politicians could just say, oh, no, it's not our fault. It's not our fault. It's just Putin.
And that's a good point. Why
keep the market elevated?
why is the gold price breaking out finally? Because this Ukraine situation, everything throws some uncertainty into the central bank thing where they'll be able to say, we're going to hold off, or we're going to err to the side of caution. We're not going to get as hawkish as we otherwise would because of what's going on. And that's the exact wrong response. And so these stagflationary dynamics right now that I see it as just pure stagflation. Look at the Atlanta Fed came out and said, first quarter GDP is tracking at zero, right? Zero. And what's the inflation in the first quarter? We're talking 7-8%. That's stagflation. And it's terribly, you know, troublesome for the Fed, because you raise rates, you got a recession. You don't raise rates, inflationary psychology, you know, takes off and you get a, you know, wage price spiral and, you know, and all these things that are, you know, economists talk about. So it's, you know, and it's the worst case scenario, really, for the prices of financial assets, you know, because right, you don't want to own bonds. I mean, you got a 2%, just over 2% on the 30-year treasury when you have 7.5% inflation. That's, you know, I want to sign up for locking up, you know, 5% losses from year to eternity. No thanks. And stocks, you know, the profit margins, right? We have record high profit margins today. So people look at the PE ratio and they go, we're 20 times, you know, maybe we're a little overvalued. But if profit margins mean revert, you're talking about that 20 PE becomes a 40 PE. And then you go, okay, now we have the most expensive stock market in the world as, you know, or in history as earnings are crashing. It's you know, something, I think that these things are starting to be priced into markets.
What's your take on real estate, Jesse? Do you look at that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, I told my wife, I said, real rates are going to be negative from here as far as the eye can see. Buy up as, you know, we should be buying up as much residential real estate as we can get our hands on. Right? I mean, if I can borrow at 3 and, you know, and buy residential, buy it up all day long. Now residential has just screamed higher in the last, you know, part of it. And I obviously had no idea a pandemic was coming or anything like that. I just, you know, if you can borrow at negative real rates, you know, borrow and put it into real assets, that's a no-brainer trade. Yeah. I do think, you know, because of these dynamics, the demographic dynamic I mentioned, you know, before, I think that's probably, you know, bullish for real estate. But I really think, you know, just in the broad scheme of things, I want to own real assets. You know, real estate's one of those, because I do think we are going to have negative real interest rates for a prolonged period of time. There's no way we can afford, I mean, with 7.5% inflation, imagine where the economy would be with a 10-year treasury note at 9%, right? I mean, the stock market would be down 60, 70, 80%. Yeah. Residential real estate would be down 50, 60, 70% with 10% mortgage rates. I mean, there's no way the Fed can allow for that. So I think, you know, people haven't talked about it for a long time now, maybe, you know, I haven't heard anything in the last year at least, But I think we're probably going to see yield curve control at some point. People are going to start talking about it again, I think, in the next few months. Because if the Fed does try and get out of the Treasury market, you know, that I think that's why we're seeing rates go up, even as the economy slows, is the Fed's kind of pulling their thumb off the Treasury market. And so rates are trying to normalize, but there's no way they can afford to let the Treasury market, you know, rates across the curve normalize. It just would be, you know, it'd be way, way, way too painful. And so I think, you know, at some point we might see them, you know, they're not going to call it QE. They might call it yield curve control, but I think they're going to, you know, realize we can't afford rates above a certain level. And they're going to say, we're going to have to pin the 10-year 2% or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. They're going to have to figure out some name that's, you know, from a PR standpoint that makes it sound nice, warm and fuzzy. Yeah, you know, that's what they always do. We'll have to see. Jesse, I know I've kept you longer than an hour. I appreciate your time. For all the viewers who want to find out more about what you do, where can they go?
TheFelderReport.com is my website. I try and put up a blog post there once a week. On occasion, there'll be a podcast when I get around to it. I'm not nearly as productive as you are, George. But when I have somebody interesting I want to talk to, I put one up there. And then Jesse Felder. Say again.
What's the name of the podcast?
Super Investors and the Art of Worldly Wisdom. Yeah. I took it from, you know, Warren Buffett wrote a thing back in the 60s about the super investors of Graham and Doddsville. Hmm. And then Charlie Munger gave a speech at, I think, USC Business School on the on worldly wisdom. And so it's kind of my, you know, the name is a tribute to those two great investors. So, yeah. And then just on Twitter, I just add Jesse Felder, and I try and share a bunch of what I'm reading and charts and things over there.
Awesome, Jesse. Can't wait to do it again, my friend. Have a great day.
Hey, you too. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.